Come here, come here. Okay, what do the following have in common? Tattoo sleeves, corporate boards, justice for women and children, and fried shrimp have in common? You're going to find out during this amazing interview with the Honorable Judge Rosie Speedlin Gonzalez. So this is a conversation that I keep having. When I was a kid, my parents, one of them was a Democrat, one was a Republican, and their friends were running for elective office and doing these things, and we would support. It didn't matter what side they were on. We would go because they were friends. And at the table, we would have conversations about politics and religion, and they were civil. What is it, do you think, that has changed that makes us unable to do that in most situations now?
Honestly, I think it's the World Wide Web and the internet. You and I grew up in a time where that commercial came on at 10 o'clock. Do you know where your kids are? Right? You and I knew that at midnight, we saw that little doo on the screen, right? All the stations went off the air and none of them came back on till 6 in the morning until Linda Ellerbe came on with Turner Broadcasting. And I remember Linda Ellerbe because that's when I saved my money from working at the skating rink to buy myself a little TV set that I could have in my bedroom and I could watch all night long. And I just followed Linda Ellerbe. And so you go Linda Ellerbe and beyond, and now you get into the 90s and the World Wide Web. And when we were kids, it took a week, maybe two, to find out there had been a tsunami in Bali, right? We didn't know the magnitude of devastation across the world, right? Now you get a live feed of what's happening. The world has literally shrunk before our eyes. You and I had to go to the library and go through the catalog index to find information we needed for our research papers that we had to type, right? Now, what's a library, right? Unless you want to go in and get air conditioning and access Wi-Fi. Now, all you do is you pick up your phone and there's your World Book Encyclopedia, which our parents provided for me and my brother. And we were the cool kids on the block because we had the black and brown one with the gold edging. We had the fancy one. And of course, the most used book was the S because that had sex in it. And it showed you all the, you know, anatomically correct parts and everything. Anyway, I think that's what's wrong. I think it's easier for someone to get spoon-fed something than to do the hard work to educate yourself and to look at all angles. It's just too much work and too much time. When you can just get on TikTok or get on a social media app and read incessantly, nonstop, you know, 10 seconds, 15 seconds, 30 seconds, 3 minutes, and it's nonstop information coming this way. And that's all of a sudden you're an expert on what? You're opining because you're behind a screen and you're safe. And we are watching our youth, our kids come into our fold of living as adults with that an inability to socialize, an inability to have a conversation with an individual or make eye contact, and high levels of anxiety, high levels of maladaptive behaviors and depression because they haven't left their house or their room in weeks and don't know how to interact with other people in the world, whether it's their family, their neighbors at school. And I think we're doing a huge disservice to our children. And I tell people, your kid, and I learned this from a therapist, your kid doesn't need a phone unless they're 16 and now you're having to figure out where they're at in the car you let them drive. Because before that, you should know where they're at and who they're with.
Yeah. And they should never have unrestricted internet.
I agree. Understand. People talk about sex trafficking and I warn them, this is the portal to hell. I said, you want your kid to be tapped into by a pedophile, a sex offender, you give them a phone, unfettered access to whatever they want. And there will be a sex offender, a pedophile reaching out to them within hours, posing as a child, enticing them to meet them down the street at the 7-Eleven to get an ice cream or a Slurpee. And there goes your child.
Oh my gosh. Something else that makes you unique is as a judge is the tattoos. So, and you know, I think if I was in your courtroom as a defendant, it may make me relax a little bit and think, okay, wait a minute. She's, you know, clearly, you know, it thinks a little bit differently than other judges do because a lot of judges don't have that. So tell me the story behind how that started.
It started with my desire to connect with my dad. My dad had a cross, a very rudimentary, crude, you knew it was like Indian ink kind of cross on his forearm. And the desire to have a tattoo stemmed from there. And my first tattoo I got when I was in law school, I was already 33. And I did a lot of things after I kind of felt like I was out from under the control of my parents. And so law school was the first one. And it just grew from there. And they're not all over my body. They're just on my arms. And there's one on my chest and a couple on my back. And that's, you know, I lie. I've got one on each of my calves now. And I think I'm done. And it just kind of, all the tattoos I have are original art. They're not something out of a book or a stencil. And it just kind of, I highlight women, and like I have an Aztec warrior princess on one arm. I have a painting by a woman, Adriana Garcia, of a woman, and she named it Standing Tall because it's a 7-foot painting that I got transferred onto my arm. And I like to prove people wrong. And so that was another comment I got early on. You're never going to get elected with tattoos. What kind of judge would that be? And I'm like, why does that affect my ability to think and reason and, you know, critically analyze things and have good judgment just because I choose to have artwork on my body? So, you know, I prove the naysayers wrong and I make people uncomfortable and I see it as that's their issue, not mine. And, you know, and in the end, they're covered up at the bench. My sleeves on my robe come up. They see it like out here in the public and they're like, oh, wow, you got tattoos. I'm like, yeah.
So as a woman of a certain age, because, you know, we're in our 50s and I don't have tattoos. My kids, my older kids all do. And they're like, Mom, you've got to get one. But I'm looking at my skin and I'm like,
You've got beautiful skin. Let me tell you, the lighter your skin, the more the color pops on those tattoos. So if you were to consider it, I'd say to you, get something as colorful as you can get it because it's going to look beautiful.
Well, thank you. But you know, I don't know. So we'll see.
You want to choose an area that's got a little bit more cushion on it, if you know what I mean, because that's where it won't be as sore. If you get into your wrist area or bony areas, that is very, very painful to endure.
That is really good to know. See, and I think, you know, I love that you're a little bit of a rebel. I think that it's really cool because I've always, you know, I want to push just a little and do follow the rules. Yes, I like rules. I like to be on the right side of them. But I also question people that tell me rules that don't make any sense.
Sure.
What?
So I really started enjoying life once I let go of this concept. Caring what other people think. Once I stopped caring what other people think, life became grand.
Yeah, I think that is a blessing of coming, of being older, is that I feel like for me and a lot of the women I talk to, the older we are, the more we're like, you know what? There's something about that came with turning 50 when we finally got to say, you know what? The things I did care that you thought about, I don't care anymore. I'm going to be myself. And I'm going to be so much more secure, which I never thought possible because I always looked at older people and I was like, oh, they're all like wrinkly, whatever, you know? But for some reason, I'm more secure in my own body and in what I'm thinking than I ever was. And I don't know, I like it. So it's nice to see you out there, you know, fighting the good fight. And yeah.
And I have fun doing it, you know? And yeah, I don't skip a beat. And if someone makes a face or makes a comment, I just keep on rolling.
Yeah, because, yeah.
What else? How miserable do you have to be to make that face or to make that comment?
Oh, my gosh. And people are so rude. Oh, which is, and YouTube, which is, so I do this weird thing. I don't know if you know. It's called Shower Thoughts. Oh, my goodness. 150,000 views in a month. People like it. It's bizarre. 10 seconds, you know, you were saying like the 10-second scroll. So I thought, well, at least I'll add something. I'll make them think in their scroll. So we're doing this thing. But it's along the lines of YouTube, a lot of people take your court things and they put them on their own court channels. How do you feel about that?
Well, you know, I started out on the bench wanting to weigh because there was so much chatter in the community about, you know, the secrecy in courts and not knowing what goes on in courts and misconceptions about what happens in a courtroom. And I was trying to find a way to, you know, have a broadcast, a live feed of what was happening in the courtroom so that people knew what was happening in a family violence court in Bexar County in Texas, the county with the highest number of family violence cases in the whole state. And, you know, we kind of gave up on any idea of being able to do that, you know, and then COVID hit. And I was like, oh my God, what a gift, right? So we had to pivot and use technology to keep the courts open and to make the public aware that we were continuing to work. And that is what we now know as Zoom. And we've kept it up. And the whole goal was to educate the public, to lift the shroud of mystery away from the judicial branch and for the public to come into the courtroom and watch. And that is the purpose of it. And if people are using it for that, to share what's going on in the courtroom, whether they like it or not, now you know. You know what I do. You know the protocols. You know how it operates. And you can watch on any given day. So I feel fine about it.
See, I love it. I had no idea. And when I tell people I watch court, they're like, oh, Judge Judy. No. Nothing like that. It's actual. All right. So one thing that you put a lot of time into, and it took you a couple of years to do it, is the pride flag in your courtroom. And there's a lot written about that. And so I wanted to ask, and I know this seems like an obvious question, but what was it about that that made you want to fight until it happened?
Well, I think what folks need to understand is that in the heart of Texas, in Bexar County, I was in 2018, the first and only openly gay countywide candidate to win their election as a countywide elected official. That was huge for our community. Now, I will have to say this. There were, in the past, LGBT judges, but they were not out. They were not out for political reasons. They were not out for safety reasons. I had good friends on the bench, and they were afraid to come out for fear of retribution, of harm being threatened to them. And so we had to keep that tapped down and secret, not public. Now, I was told when I ran the first time in 2010, the second time in 2014, I would never, ever win as an out candidate. I was told by my own party, and I'm a Democrat. And then lo and behold, I win in 2018. And it was a huge accomplishment for the LGBT community in San Antonio. Why is that important? Because San Antonio is home to the largest number per capita of same-sex families in the whole country. And it's that because we value family and we don't care what family looks like as long as children are loved and taken care of. And they look to me as, this is a community of over 60% Latinos. So I'm Latina, I'm LGBT, and that impacts into many areas of our community. And so when I was sworn in as judge, a local LULAC chapter, the League of United Latin American Citizens, the Orgullo Council of LULAC, Orgullo translates into pride in Spanish, the Pride Council of LULAC locally, gifted me at my swearing in this pride flag. And I was also gifted an American flag that was brought in. She marched in the colors to my swearing in by a combat vet who was also LGBT. So I have the American flag and the rainbow flag, the pride flag, right outside my chambers. I felt compelled. I felt I had a duty to post that flag in the courtroom. Off to the side, not next to the American or state flag, but a few feet to the side, because the pride flag is a symbol of equality. Equality. It's not a symbol of gayness. It's a symbol of equality. And what better place to hang and display a symbol of equality, equal justice, than in a courtroom? Of course, some people didn't agree with that, and they filed their complaints. And I was, at that time, disciplined by the Judicial Commission and was instructed to not only take my flag down, I had to remove all rainbows from the courtroom, whether that was my mouse pad, a pen I was using, my glasses, or my robe, which had a little strip of sarape, not a rainbow, but sarape, multicolored sarape right across this way. I could not wear that robe on the bench, I was told. And what was the clincher for me on that order from the commission was that they barred me from being a visiting judge after I retired from the bench. It didn't matter if I retired after 4 years or after 20 years. They said I could not be a visiting judge anywhere. And that's why I truly appealed the decision by the commission. And I got a great attorney, Deanna Whitley, and we fought it and we appealed it. And they wanted to hear us on Zoom during COVID. And we said, no, we want to be heard in person in Austin at the Supreme Court of Texas. And we waited. And so they appoint three judges to hear your case. When COVID started, the breakdown was two conservative judges, one progressive judge. By the time COVID was over, it was two progressive judges and one conservative judge. And that helped us, I think. And because they're elected as well, and they have to answer to their constituents. In addition to, they believed it was an infringement of my rights. So people asked me why it's not in the courtroom again. And I said, we've made our point. And it doesn't need to be in the courtroom for me to continue to make my point. The whole world knows how I was treated by the Texas Commission on Judicial Conduct. And it sits outside my chambers. And I back, you know, from time to time, I'll wear the robe that they said I couldn't wear in the courtroom. I have my mouse pad back up there. And it's no secret who I am and what communities I represent on that bench, just as who I am inherently. And so we've done what we set out to do. One of my good friends is a man by the name of Michael Quintanilla, and he was just the grand marshal of our local Fiesta Flambeau Parade, but he used to be a fashion editor. He's a local guy, went to school in South San Antonio at Burbank High School, but he ended up going into journalism, and he was a fashion editor and fashion journalist in Dallas and then for the LA Times and came back to San Antonio. And he just traveled all over the world attending fashion shows. And so he and I talk a lot. And every year we talk about what's the color of the year, what's the latest fashion trends. And we love a lot of color and we bounce stuff things off each other. So I follow his lead when it comes to fashion.
Oh, that's so cool. I wish I had someone that helped me with fashion. All right. So today I'm so excited to have the Honorable Rosie Spiedelin Gonzalez with me. Thank you so much, Rosie, for taking time out of your day to join me.
It's always an honor for me to share experiences and share knowledge. And if any of our stories and conversation helps anyone, even one individual tonight, then we've done more than I think most people do in a day.
Right. And that's honestly exactly why you're here, because, you know, I've been watching court on YouTube and it's interesting. Every judge has a personality, but the thing that just really draws me to you is your passion for helping women and children. And the way when something comes up about a child, you're like, no, I'm going to protect this child. So what is it about you particularly that makes you stand out as the protector of women and children?
You know, I think I fell into it, Jen. And what I mean by that is in the 80s, I was the product of that me generation. I graduated from college in the mid 80s and went straight into graduate school only to flub it up because I was more interested at the age of 21 in being out at the clubs and enjoying the 80s lifestyle and with everything that it came with. And I dropped out of graduate school. And I had to come up with the plan to tell my parents I dropped out of graduate school. And so I walked down the road from the school I was attending, St. Mary's University. And there was at the time a place called the Southwest Neuropsychiatric Institute for Children. And it was a lockdown residential facility for kids with psychiatric issues. And we had a padded room. They each were locked into their room at night. The children's ages range from 12 to 18. I was on the admissions unit. So I saw these kids as raw as you could see them coming in untreated. And we stabilized them so that they can move on to other cottages on the property that gave them more appropriate treatment after they stabilized. That job was the catalyst and catapult into an 11-year career in the social services fields, adolescent correction fields, and education. So from there, I worked on the admissions unit as staff, went on to work as an investigator for Child Protective Services. I worked for communities and schools with gang members in South San Antonio. I worked for Catholic Charities as a community emergency assistance program coordinator, helping folks in their most destitute times needing money. I went on to work as a program director for the Mexican American Unity Council, developing a resiliency curriculum for adolescents, first-time juvenile offenders. Went on to work as a juvenile probation officer in Travis County and had three specialized caseloads: sex offenders, juvenile offenders, and Spanish-speaking offenders. Towards my third year in Travis County, my dad got ill. I went back home to Brownsville and taught special ed at my old high school. And it was in the midst of all that my mom asked me to revisit higher education for myself, specifically law school. And I said, "Mom, I don't know." She goes, "We'll do whatever we need to do." I had to retake some classes. I took the prep course for the LSAT. And lo and behold, my alma mater admitted me into law school. And the rest is, you know, the same populations that I helped as in the social work fields that I did. I can't call myself a social worker because I didn't have a social work degree, but I did social work. And the same populations I helped in that capacity, I ended up helping as a lawyer. And so I always told people all I was a glorified social worker. I was just making more money because I was still helping the same populations, women and children, disenfranchised populations, at-risk kids. And I did that for the 16 years I was a lawyer. And I had a very strong desire to help people who could not afford the big-time lawyers. And the way I accommodated them was I gave them a payment plan. I didn't charge them by the hour. I gave them a flat fee and they appreciated that. And they could come in as long as they were on a payment plan. I didn't care if they paid me $5 a week, $50 a week, $100 a week, as long as they kept coming in to pay off. They could be paying me for 5 years for something I did for them in a year's time. But it meant a lot to them and it meant a lot to me that I could help them. And so that's what I mean by I fell into it. And that passion just grew. And I saw a lot of abuse. I saw a lot of misfortune, a lot of bad luck, a lot of being at the wrong place at the wrong time. I also saw a lot of evil. And I always, you know, people ask me, why'd you do it? I said, if it wasn't me, who was going to do it? And I took a lot of pride in being able to help those populations. By the time I got elected to the bench in late 2018, I was the only board certified child welfare law specialist in South Texas. This is before Texas started a board certification for the same type of area of practice. I was certified by the National Association of Counsel for Children. And so that's what I came onto the bench with. That type of background with that certification. And I knew what I had experienced was family violence. Child abuse is just another name for family violence, and the victims are children. And so I saw a pattern of trauma, and I saw a pattern of addiction and mental health issues. And with Stacy's help and the encouragement of a retired judge, Judge Al Alonzo, we put our heads together and we came up with an avenue, not for victims, but for the perpetrators of family violence. And because that's where it starts, with the act of violence. And that's where we can stop it, with curing or addressing the trauma in that perpetrator that triggers the violence. And that's what resulted in Reflejo Court, the only court of its kind in the state of Texas.
Well, that was literally going to be my next question, because I read your article that just came out in March of this year. And, you know, trauma-informed care is a thing that is a buzzword right now. Can you explain what that is, though, if people are listening and they have no idea?
So good timing on this question, because I just attended a meeting of the Trauma Consortium with the City of San Antonio on Wednesday. And that was a question, and they wanted everyone in attendance to talk about what trauma-informed care meant to them. In the end, we all agreed that it was a way in which we bring in the people that come in for services. How do they get greeted? How are we sensitive to their lived experience? How do we keep them focused on improving their lot and improving their ability to cope from our end, and not creating a hostile environment for them that makes them afraid or embarrassed to address the issues that got them to where they're at in that moment? And so trauma-informed care is being sensitive to their trauma, because we know that everyone has some level of trauma, but their trauma has brought them into the social services or criminal justice fold. And we want them to get better. We don't want to send them off worse than how they came in. That's trauma-informed care.
I like that. And, you know, and I had talked to, you know, I had talked to Judge Boyd, and Judge Boyd is another person that wants to help people, because, you know, some judges, you know, you give them their sentence, let them move on. But you seem to take it a whole level further in actually creating these new things that are amazing like that. And also, you created a special drug court, did you,
That is Reflejo Court, and it was the newest court, specialty court in Bexar County until last year. And Judge Melissa Vada started a community court, also a specialty court that focuses on individuals who are without housing, who have a substance abuse issue. All specialty courts have a common denominator. They must have a specialty. They must have a drug court treatment or a drug treatment component, an addiction treatment component. So Judge Vada addresses the drug issue with folks without housing. We address it with a very narrow population. Our program was developed on the model that is provided by who used to be the National Association of Drug Court Professionals. They are now known as All Rise. And they provide the outline of best practices and 10 key components that every specialty court must adhere to. And we have thousands of these courts across the country. Texas has 3 metropolitan areas that all have within their jurisdiction 15 specialty courts. That's Tarrant County and Dallas-Fort Worth area, Bexar County, and Harris County. And ours was the 14th court to be established. We got the help from Al Alonzo, who established the very first specialty court in Bexar County back in 2001. And his was only for misdemeanor cases, general jurisdiction, and that grew. And in Bexar County, we have that court still exists, adult drug court. We have veterans court at the misdemeanor level. We have veterans court at the felony level. We have the felony drug court. CPS has a drug court for children removed from parents with the substance abuse issue. They also have a court for children removed due to domestic violence and substance abuse issues. Juvenile court has several specialty courts. And so the list, and we have a Esperanza court for individuals arrested for adult sex crimes. And then we have Reflejo Court. Reflejo Court focuses on only first-time offenders of family violence with a substance abuse issue. It's all science-based, okay? So follow me on this. When I took the bench, Judge Alonzo said to me, did you know that 85 to 90% of your defendants in your court come in having been arrested either under the influence of a drug or have a substance abuse issue? And out of that universe of defendants, almost 100% of them will self-disclose that they themselves are adult survivors of childhood trauma, neglect, or abuse. Okay, so we took that population, we did research, we find out that first-time offenders are the most vulnerable offenders. This is when an individual who's been arrested for family violence doesn't want anybody to know they've been arrested for family violence. They don't want their children to know if the children didn't find out. They don't want their in-laws to know. They don't want their parents to know. They don't want their siblings, neighbors. They don't want their employer to know. All for fear that they will be rejected, they will be ostracized or fired. So they will do anything to get this case taken care of, dismissed. And what we do with Reflejo Court, we also expunge it from their record. Once they complete our program successfully, the program can take as little as 10 months to complete, but they get up to 2 years max to complete a five-phase program. That's what this program is. It's an intensive outpatient substance abuse program that is trauma-centered. So what does that mean? The five phases, I tell the participants, are like five of your grades. First grade, you learn your alphabet. Second grade, you learn how to make words with those letters. Third grade, you know how to make sentences with those words. Fourth grade, you're going to write paragraphs with those sentences. And by fifth grade, you are writing your story. So that's how it progresses. And we give them the skills and knowledge to be self-reflective and understand their own trauma, understand their triggers, and learn ways in which to respond to triggers as opposed to react to triggers. They must maintain long-term sobriety because it was during the time that they were using drugs that, for whatever reason, their inhibitions were lowered and they acted violently toward a loved one. And so we monitor that. We get their trauma addressed. We get them sober. If they don't have housing, we provide housing for them. And if they don't have employment, we find employment for them. So when they graduate with a toolbox of everything they could possibly need to not reoffend and not reenter the criminal justice system. We've had up till now 28 graduates, 27 have not reoffended. That's important because every offender of family violence, if left to their own devices, can create anywhere between 10 to 15 victims of their violence throughout their lifetime. And if they have children, that becomes a generational problem. So if they have children, part of their therapeutic milieu is to complete a parenting class that works with parents who are involved with domestic violence to minimize the exposure to the children and minimize the chances of those children repeating the sins of their fathers and mothers.
Yeah. And the first question I was going to say is, what is your success rate? And that is an incredible, incredible success rate. And so another question I have, so someone's listening and they think, well, but they've been to you in court. Why would they need another court? So how would you explain drug court?
So with regular probation, you have different avenues. You have deferred adjudication probation. That means if they complete their probation, usually it's not less than a 10-month offer, and it can be up to 2 years. Once they complete their probation, their case is dismissed. Their arrest will stay on their record unless they pay an attorney to get that expunged. Okay. So what does that mean for someone that takes a deferred adjudication probation? That means that if they go and apply for a job or for housing, want to rent or lease an apartment or a house, those individuals can do a criminal background check on them. And they don't see that the case is dismissed. They see the arrest that's still on their record for a violent offense. And guess what? They won't get the job and they won't get the house or the apartment. They'll be denied. For a person on regular probation, that's not expungible because it's not dismissed. They'll have a conviction. And so it's for us, it's different because I've created relationships with folks who can control that. And they allow for the case to be dismissed, our district attorney and our district clerk foots the bill for the expungement expense. And the district attorney has agreed to allow that case to be expunged as soon as possible, as opposed to having to wait a number of years before you can ask for it to be expunged. So that's the difference between Reflejo Court and other probation avenues. We truly are a second chance, pure as you can get program that gets the case dismissed and expunged at no cost to the defendant. And so we truly give them a second chance to start over and start in a healthy manner, not hurting the people they love the most in their life.
And that makes so much sense because instead of putting them in prison where they're going to see more violence, you're actually teaching them how to not keep doing it and saving the kids and their grandkids.
And so we like to say we like to make tax burdens into taxpayers.
I like that. I like that a lot. So if you could write one law, what to help women and children, what would that one law be? If you could write it and pass it all by yourself.
Well, you know, let me just say, we did write the bill for this court. Stacey and I did for Reflejo Court. It was House Bill 3529. And then we wrote the Resort Bill, which was House Bill 4333, which allowed us to keep going. You know, there's so much need in so much area. And I think if I could write a House bill, it would be a House bill that would create a fund accessible by any family member in need of transition services, either as an offender who often gets excluded from the home with the no contact order and they have nowhere to go, right? Because often they're the primary provider for the family, and they make most of the salary that pays for the home expenses, but they're kicked out. And they have no savings and they have nowhere to go. They end up on the street or in a shelter, or the victim and the children who end up at a battered women's shelter, have no savings, have no way to get into an apartment that's safe for them, have no way to, you know, pay for groceries or anything else. So I would create a fund that provides that kind of accessibility to financial resources to help them get past this hump, whether it's just a hump or it's a life-changing experience. For many victims, they have to not look back. They have to not re-engage with this person who may not be willing or not have the access to Reflejo Court to fix their issues, right? To address their issues and to make them safer people to be around. And so I think that's what I would do. And Stacey and I have always talked about, we like to pine away and think about what we would do if we won the mega million lottery. And we both have always said, we'd give all these millions of dollars to this particular fund to help families that are just caught up in this family violence cycle. And when we say families, we mean everyone. We mean the offender, we mean the victim, and we mean the children.
That is a beautiful thing. I like that a lot. You know, because I think people don't realize that, yes, somebody's committed a crime, but they still have a life to live, right?
Well, and we want to change. Yeah, and you know what, Jen? I don't believe that a single person wakes up in the morning and says, let me find a way to go to jail today. I'm going to find a way to end up in jail tonight. Not a single person does that. People end up in jail due to poor decisions many times, and other times because they're triggered. And if you talk to a lot of our participants, they'll tell you, I don't remember what I did. Now, it could have been a combination of doing the drugs or drinking, but it's also when you hear people say, I saw red, I was so upset, I saw red. We're talking about blackouts. We're talking about disassociation due to their own past trauma, and they don't remember what they did. And much of that is a coping mechanism where the brain shuts down to protect the individual from further trauma that damages their psyche. And there's a whole set of research avenues that you can go down that verify that. And people don't want to spend the time learning about this dynamic, because we're in a hang 'em high state. We're in Texas, and it's, you know, lock them up and throw away the key. But for a fraction of the cost that it takes to house an individual in a prison or a jail, you could help a family recover and heal.
And why would you not want to do that? That just helps everybody.
I agree.
So who do you look up to at this point? Is there someone that you admire or look up to?
Well, you know, there was my mom, but she passed. She passed on my first day of judges school. And she always pushed me to do my best and do what's right by people. And then I have, you know, a tribe of local women leaders, and people that come to mind are people like former councilwoman Maria Antonieta Berriozaba, former commissioner Trish DeBerry, women like my friend Gloria Uribe, or women like Maria Elena Toralba, who's married to Judge Al Alonso, women like Marta Tijerina, who raises millions of dollars for GED services for folks who need a GED. All these women that give selflessly to community to improve our lot as individuals, but also collectively as a community. And I follow their lead, and I'm looking at how hard they work and how much they volunteer and what they do. And so that kind of has just created an extension of the child my mother created out of necessity. And so my mom worked for a Jewish family, Ben and Reuben Edelstein, and they owned a chain of furniture stores in the Rio Grande Valley. And she was their lead bookkeeper. And she worked for them for 27 years, and they were big on education. And she was big on education. And the last 4 or 5 years that she worked there, they would let her leave early from work. Instead of 5, they let her leave at 4:30 so she could go to night school. And I was like second grade through high school when she was doing this. And I saw her, if I did, late at night when she got home from school. And because she could not be with us, she found things for my brother and I to get involved in. Boy Scouts, Girl Scouts, sports, piano lessons, art lessons, Kiwanis Club, just things to do where we had adult supervision. But those experiences led us to want to always help. Where can we volunteer? Where can we do this? There's this project. There's a 5K. There's a bike-a-thon. And so that carried with me into adulthood. And so early on in my 20s, I started sitting as a board member in several nonprofits, and it has just stayed with me throughout my life. As I sit here now, I sit on the board of a cultural nonprofit called Conjunto Heritage Taller. They offer free lessons for conjunto accordion and a guitar with 6 strings called bajo sexto, and they promote conjunto music. I sit on a national board, the Sleeping in Heavenly Peace Group. And they build bunk beds for children without beds. And their motto is, no child sleeps on the floor in our town. And we have a local chapter in San Antonio, but I sit on the national board. And I sit on the board of the San Antonio AIDS Foundation. That's another board I sit on. And I sit on another board for an educational nonprofit. And it's all about trying to find ways to improve the quality of life for different sections of our community. And so I continue to do it. I was just at a board meeting last night. I have a board meeting next week. And so I space them out different weeks as different boards. And I work here all day. And then I go and do my volunteer work. And people ask me, how do you have so much energy? And it's like, I like what I do. When you like what I do, it's fun, you know?
Yeah, it doesn't feel like work at all.
It doesn't, not at all.
So along that line, what's your favorite meal? Just random question.
There was a restaurant, there still is, in Brownsville, Texas, and it's owned by Diane and her family, and they have the best breaded jumbo shrimp off the Gulf Coast. And when I was a kid, and all through until my mom stopped, all through school, on my birthday, my mom would leave work to come and pick me up and take me to lunch at the Oyster Bar and order me my dozen fried shrimp. And on the way there, she would sing, instead of happy birthday, Doris Day's Que Sera Sera to me. So I have to be careful now at my 59 plus years of age, and I've developed some issues that come with age, fatty liver, pancreatic tumors, a hiatal hernia, carpal tunnel. And in that process over the last 3 years, I learned that I was at high risk of developing diabetes. I had to watch my blood pressure. So my eating, it's been a lifestyle change. I don't have fried food anymore. So the shrimp I have has to be boiled shrimp or maybe some seafood salad. And I don't eat after 6. I can't have alcohol. People may be wondering if they see a video from me from last year to today. I've lost 45 pounds, and it's all to try and stave off medical issues as I get older. Stacy is 12 years younger than me, and this thought of her taking care of me is just not one that I want to entertain. And I don't think anybody wants to entertain a thought of people changing your diapers or leading you, you know, around because you don't have the wherewithal to do it anymore. So it's all an effort to stave off the inevitable. but I'm trying to get ahead of it. But that is my favorite food, fried shrimp from the Oyster Bar in Brownsville, Texas.
All right. And then another, okay, just random questions, because we've covered some serious stuff. We're just going to talk about a couple other things. Superpowers. If you could have any superpower, what would it be?
Ooh, be invisible.
See, that's mine. I like that. Well, and flying, because I'm a little bit afraid if I was invisible, what I might hear people say.
Oh, that's the reason why I would love to be invisible, just to get to know the true nature of people.
Oh my gosh. Well, that was my final question that I had on paper. Is there anything, you know, I do these shower thoughts and I try to come up with these brilliant things to say. Some, most of them are not brilliant. Do you have anything that I could say on there? Or do you have anything for the audience that's longer than that to leave them with, to just so that they can leave with something?
Yes, I'm going to send you a YouTube link to a 15-minute mini documentary on Reflejo Court. Mm-hmm. And in there I talk about my good friend Michael Quintanilla, who is that fashion guy but is also a volunteer on a nonprofit here in town known as the Therapeutic Justice Foundation. It was started by Judge Al Alonzo, and they provide support services for all the specialty courts. And Michael's one of their board members. And one of the things he does as a board member for the Therapeutic Justice Foundation is he is the master of ceremonies for all of the specialty court graduations. Whoever wants him, he'll do it for free. And we often talk about in our circle of professionals that hurt people hurt people. Well, he flipped it. And he says, well, what if we started looking at it as healed people heal people? And I love it. So when you heal somebody, they're able to heal others through their lived experience. And so that shifts your paradigm of thinking. Right? It goes from a paradigm of victims to a paradigm of survivors. And so if the world could just shift to supporting that paradigm of thinking, of supporting survivors, of looking at it from a standpoint where we want to heal people as part of our daily mantra, our daily paradigm, then I think we would live in a much better world.
All right, we're going to end on that, Judge Rosie. Thank you so much. I am going to put links for that and all the things we've talked about in the show notes and on the blog post. Thank you again for joining me.
Oh, I had a great time. And if you ever want me back, let's get back together. And who knows what we could do with 3 or 4 guests.
I like that. All right. Yeah. Wow. Is she amazing or what? I don't know how one person gets that many things done. She is a rock star, and I knew you would love her. And not only that, but I've listened to her, and there is an incredible group of diverse women coming to do a panel. So subscribe, follow, do all the things so that you don't miss out on that, because you are going to love it. Thank you so much for listening today. Your time is the most valuable thing you have, and I am so thankful that you chose to share it with us. Stay tuned and stay fabulous.